Welcome back to the program. Media companies today have become giant, often nameless and faceless corporate enterprises. We don't seek out a show just because it's on Fox or NBC. We don't go to a movie because it was financed or distributed by Universal or Paramount. But one of the rare exceptions to all of this is ESPN. It has become not only the dominant player in sports journalism, but one of the singular most powerful brands in all of media. Its on-air personalities have become almost as well-known as the people they cover. It has grown so large and powerful, like the business it covers, that the barriers to entry for any competitors are almost insurmountable. How did this happen? What were the moments? Who were the players that created this social, cultural, media, and even journalistic phenomenon? Well, there's a new book getting lots of attention that addresses all of these issues. We're joined today by its co-author, James Andrew Miller. He's the author of the previous books, Running in Place Inside the Senate, and the co-author of the national bestseller, Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live. It is my pleasure to welcome Jim Miller to talk about Those Guys Have All the Fun Inside the World of ESPN. Jim Miller, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. One of the things that is so fascinating about this story is that it's a little bit chicken or the egg at the beginning. We see ESPN coming along in 1979. The growth of sports as a phenomenon, as a business, as a fan base, and the growth of ESPN, and in so many ways they both fed each other as they grew along.
I think that's true, and I think that you can look to two specific examples in terms of ESPN to make that case. One is NASCAR. I mean, ESPN and NASCAR really grew up together in the 80s. In fact, Richard Petty was telling me in an interview in the book about how they saw the tremendous support that ESPN viewers were giving NASCAR, and it helped grow the sport in a variety of ways. And also with boxing, Mike Tyson talks about the fact that many people first got to see him fight on ESPN because he was doing Friday night fights throughout much of the 80s. So I think that particularly with sports like that, you can also throw in yacht racing because ESPN carried the America's Cup in 1983 and 1987. There were these, you know, kind of almost like laboratories that were used by ESPN to develop not only their fan base, but also to expand those sports.
It seems sort of out of character when you talk about yacht racing, yet as you write about it and as people have talked to you about it in this oral history, the 83 America's Cup was really a big turning point for ESPN.
I think so. I think, look, 87 was even, in some ways, even more dramatic. But I think the people started to hear about Dennis Conner and Stars and Stripes, and all of a sudden there was a place that was carrying it. You know, much like the early rounds of the NCAA men's tournament, you know, when you think about it, back then NBC was carrying the final rounds. But people who wanted to see the early rounds didn't have a place to see it until ESPN started airing those earlier rounds. So what happened was even people who didn't have cable were going to hotels that had advertised that they had cable, renting out rooms just so they could watch the early rounds of the men's basketball tournament.
Right. The other part of this story that grew up in much the same way was the cable business itself, something that started off as almost a kind of rogue business, but ESPN was very instrumental in the growth of that business as well.
Yes, and it's hard for us to, you know, think about. One of the things I try to do in the book is to take us back to the mindset of the early 80s, because you didn't have these big cable companies controlling, you know, the product. You had thousands of mom-and-pop cable systems, and so ESPN was going around to all of these people and, you know, funny stories about, you know, talking to these people one-on-one, asking them to carry ESPN on their system. And as the cable systems grew and the growth of cable grew, ESPN was able to benefit from that in a variety of ways, particularly financial, once they got the NFL in 1987.
Let's go back to the beginning. Talk a little bit about the mindset. What were the Rasmussens thinking when they decided to max out their credit cards and put up this dish in Bristol, Connecticut to do this?
Well, actually, there was a mini step beforehand, which I think is just a delicious moment, because they were originally thinking about bringing collegiate sports, highlights of collegiate sports, to the state of Connecticut. So their plan was to take these reels, these 2-inch reels of film, to various cable systems, and they were going to put them in their car and on their bikes and drive them around so the people throughout the state could see the highlights. And then they found out about the satellite. And that, I think, was the big eye-opener, as they call it in the book.
And what did they think in terms of an audience for this?
Well, they were originally thinking about Connecticut. They really did not think of, you know, that was their first goal. Once they realized what a satellite does, then they realized that they had then the potential to take things nationally.
And when they got this up and running, I mean, one of the first things on, as the legend goes, was this Australian rules football. Talk a little about that. That nobody really knew the rules.
Nobody knew the rules, and ESPN would say, you know, send us a postcard, a self-addressed postcard, if you want us to send you the rules back. And they got, like, 50, I think, like, you know, thousands of requests. But the point is, and I guess that was the reason that you know, slow pitch softball and, you know, crazy swim meets on at 3 o'clock in the morning, they couldn't afford the bigger products. They couldn't afford the NBA or Major Baseball or anything like that. So what they were doing was they were just taking advantage of anything they could possibly get their hands on. In fact, that was the genesis of ESPN covering the NFL draft. Chet Simmons, who was the president of ESPN in 1980, went to Pete Rozelle, who was then commissioner, and said, "Can we televise the draft?" And Rozelle looked at him and said, "Are you crazy? I mean, you know, what are you going to watch?" And Simmons said, "Let that be my problem." And here we are 32 years later, and it's, you know, a gigantic event.
Right. The Gettys come in with money. That's really a key turning point in ESPN history.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, the truth is that without Getty money, we're not talking about ESPN right now. They had been to many, many other potential investors. Everybody had turned them down. The business plan was barely a business plan. It was a couple of pieces of paper. They had no idea how to project how many people would be watching. But there was one guy at Getty who, just for a variety of reasons, just thought, you know what, this is going to be worth looking at. And so he put it together. He put the money together. And it's funny to think about, you know, here's this oil company with this little holding outside of nowhere in Bristol, Connecticut. It just doesn't make any sense at all. But at the same time, it did, because the guy, Stuart Easy at Getty, loved sports.
What happened after that? Once there was money, what started to happen inside ESPN?
I guess as we trace the pedigree of its success, the most important thing after the Getty money is that they figure out a way to go from paying the cable systems to carry ESPN to literally having the cable systems pay them. And that paradigm shift turns out to be the big game changer, because then what happens is ESPN now has a dual revenue stream. So they have money coming in from advertisers, and they got money coming in from cable operators. And to this day, that is the biggest fundamental difference between what ESPN does and, let's say, what CBS Sports does.
Right. That dual revenue stream is really the key to the success of the business model. I mean, we'll talk more about the product, but the business model is really, really changes once that dual revenue stream is there, and it allows the company to do a lot more.
Yes, I mean, look, I'm fond of saying, if you took my daughter's fifth grade class and you said to everybody, "Okay, kids, here we go. Here's two companies. One's called, you know, let's say CBS, and they're going to get their money from advertising. And then here on this other company called ESPN, they're going to get their money from advertising and cable operators. And the longer, who's going to win? Raise your hand. Which one do you think?" And, you know, it's true. So I think you're absolutely right with your premise to the question. It's a fundamentally different kind of business.
It's also fascinating, and you certainly spend a lot of time on this, talking about the personalities in those early days. And it was what we would consider today, and you know, and maybe Silicon Valley even as an example. It was a startup. It was a wild and crazy time in terms of what was going on. There were no rules, because they were paving new ground every step of the way.
And one of the great things that happens when you're a startup is, you know, you take chances on people, and you can't be picky. So Chris Berman's, you know, basically right out of college. Bob Lee's, you know, a year out of college. These guys come, and they're getting opportunities at ESPN that they would never, ever have at the networks. So I give them a lot of credit for taking a gamble. time after time, people told me in interviews for the book that their parents would—they'd hear that their parents would hear that they're going to this cable thing up in Bristol, Connecticut, and saying, "What are you, out of your mind?" But you know, that's what happens with a startup. You get incredible opportunities.
And like startups, and not unlike the tech world today, kids grew up wanting to go to work there. I mean, certainly you tell the story about Erin Andrews, who, you know, in high school knew she wanted to work for ESPN.
Right. I think that, you know, of course, that's a little bit later on.
Right.
But I do think you're right, because what happens is, as people continue to watch and these personalities start to emerge, you get a sense that, it becomes a destination. It's not just something that, it's funny, because they used to try, and it used to be a hassle to get people to come to work in Bristol, Connecticut. And then all of a sudden, you know, towards the early 90s, people are clamoring to be there.
Every company, regardless of industry, particularly startups, over time develop a culture of their own. Talk a little bit about the culture of ESPN.
Well, it's changed dramatically during the last 32 years. Much like a lot of startups in the beginning, it was not organized in a way that was equal to the challenges of the workplace. And what I mean by that is that, you know, for years, they didn't even have an HR department. So what you had was this influx of mostly college kids working all hours of the day and night without a lot of supervision. And so the culture in the early years was defined by, I think, people say it's Animal House or Frat House or that kind of thing. And it certainly wasn't what you would call, an acceptable business environment. There were too few rules, and those rules weren't even being paid attention to by a lot of people. I think gradually, particularly towards the end of the 80s, they start to develop a kind of construct, an architecture for the kind of culture that they want. And some of that is defined by better treatment for women and more diversity and some of the other things that you might expect. They have some hiccups in the 90s. They're taken over by Disney in 96, which then has its own particular effect on the culture. But I think that in the last decade, what they've figured out is they can't always prevent problems, but they're going to get better at responding to them. And I'll give you a quick example. So the day that Tony Kornheiser walks into the office and decides to become a fashion critic rather than a sportscaster and goes out to Hannah Storm, you know, he's one of their biggest stars, but he's suspended for 2 weeks without pay. You know, that's a sign to the culture. That says that kind of behavior and those kinds of comments about a colleague are not going to be tolerated. That's, you know, there are many different ways to define a culture and to shape a culture. And one of the things that they've become particularly good at is drawing a line of what is acceptable and what is not.
How has the company managed, really on two fronts? One, to keep the energy and quality of the product up when clearly the barriers to any kind of competitive entry are incredibly high, number one. And two, to inculcate this more corporate culture. Both of those things would seem to be anathema to the energy and quality of some of the early product. And yet they've managed to keep that up. How has that happened?
I think that part of it is the kind of people that the company attracts. You know, I mean, one might say the same thing about Microsoft 10 years ago, you know, such domination with Windows, and why did they just... But I don't think... Look, there's nobody at ESPN who is putting their feet up on a desk and stretching their arms behind their head, because if they did it, they'd get fired. And by the way, there have been people that have come in to ESPN with, you know, a particular kind of laid-back or not aggressive kind of posture, and they don't last long. This is a very competitive, aggressive place. They want to be everywhere that sports is. They want to dominate. And that is kind of instilled in everybody every single day.
It is still that testosterone-driven culture.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, look, you know, they are doing everything. This right now, even during this impasse in the labor negotiations for the NFL. Well, they're not sitting around. They're still, like, you know, banging their heads against the wall. How they're going to make their NFL coverage better. They every single day they are doing something to try and distance themselves further from the competition, or get better at something, or get something that they haven't gotten before, or, you know, do it in a different way.
One of the things you talk about, and this goes to the heart of really what you're saying, is that, you know, you can go into a lot of companies today, big corporations, and walk through the halls of their executive offices and not know exactly what it is they do. There's no such mistake at ESPN.
Yes, I mean, that's one, it was really one of the lovely, I mean, fun, great things about being up in Bristol. You know, when you walk from one building to another, there's not carpeting. It's AstroTurf with yard markers, like you're walking on a football field. I mean, when you're, there's pictures of, you know, sports greats and memorabilia all over the place. There's quotes from Yogi Berra in the cafeteria. I mean, every single, you know, facet of the campus there speaks to sports. You just know that you're in a world of sports. It's like being in a biosphere.
You mentioned the 1996 takeover by Disney. Talk a little bit about that and how it changed the place.
Well, I mean, look, there's a lot of, I found the interviews with Michael Eisner and a lot of other people for the book about that time to be quite interesting, because there's kind of a Rashomon effect. Did Disney buy ABC Cap Cities for ESPN? Michael Eisner will try and convince you that was the case. Other people say, no way, he didn't really know what he was getting. But what becomes clear is that ESPN is the golden child very quickly, and Disney goes out of its way to, this, particularly with this 1998 football deal with the NFL where they get a full season for the first time, they do things to the cable operators that have never been done before in terms of price increases. And Disney uses its might and ESPN's might to impose increases that have just, you know, never been done before. And it winds up being, isn't it interesting that it winds up being that ESPN becomes more valuable to Disney than basically any other part of the empire?
Mm-hmm. And Michael Eisner really played a key role, it seems, in those NFL negotiations, that his toughness was pretty critical.
Well, it, you know, let's start with the obvious. It could not have, that deal would not have gone through without his approval and support. But also, his aggressiveness, which, you know, is detailed in the book, is, like I said before, unparalleled. So I think that you got to give Eisner a lot of credit.
Talk a little bit about the ESPN brand and the effort that has gone into it over the years and through all of the different administrations and incarnations of ESPN to really protect and grow the brand.
I think that one of the things that, I mean, it starts with a very simple premise, which is that basically they're there to serve the sports fan. That's the DNA of the brand. They just want to be to serve the sports fan. So that means wherever the sports fan is, they want to be there. One of the reasons why they went and did ESPN the magazine was because an executive said, I want people bringing it into the bathroom with them. I want ESPN in the bathroom. I mean, it's that kind of thinking.
It was also competition with Sports Illustrated as well.
Right. For Michael Eisner, it was personal because he wanted to whoop, you know, Ted Turner. But the point is that in terms of the brand, they made a big mistake with the mobile phone initially, but they didn't give up on it because they knew that sports fans were going to be getting information from their phones. So they went back and did it a different way. I mean, that brand is all about being every place. They want people to think, when they think of sports, they want people to think about ESPN.
There's also been a sense of, as large as the company has gotten, of keeping the kind of flexibility and entrepreneurial nature of the place. I mean, so many things that you detail in this story, whether it's how, you know, this is Sports Center came about, or you know, the later decision to go after the World Cup, that a lot of those things were decisions that were made outside of what they thought they were going to be doing.
Yes. I mean, part of it also is The agenda of ESPN sometimes can be a function of who is in charge, because there are times when, you know, John Skipper, who's in head of content right now, is a huge soccer fan. They're doing the World Cup, the ladies, the Women's World Cup right now in Germany. They did the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. He's also a big proponent of live coverage. Mark Shapiro, who had basically the same job before, loved live stuff, but he was also very interested in scripted drama. So they did, you know, shows like Playmakers and reality show TV, TV shows and stuff like that. So that was that was important to him. So, you know, I think that under the rubric of serving the fan, there's a lot of variations and a lot of different ways you could go.
You mentioned Mark Shapiro. He was one of the most important players, really, in the evolution of the content of ESPN.
I think so. He was incredibly aggressive, and he also had a different way of managing the troops, as he called them. And I think that, you know, he had a huge impact on the culture. One of the things that Mark did, in addition to the NBA and Wimbledon and other things, was he developed Pardon the Interruption, Round the Horn, and some reality shows. And so he was very ambitious, very aggressive.
And John Skipper, who you mentioned, who followed him, came to it with really not a lot of television experience.
I love that part of the story. I think that people would be, you know, people have genuinely been surprised when they've read that. Can you imagine? Here we have, you know, a new century beginning. ESPN's the dominant broadcasting empire that it is, and the guy who's going to run content doesn't have any television experience. I think that shows, you know, something about George Bodenheimer, that he has the ability to take a, you know, some people might not call it a risk, but I think, you know, just on the face of it, that he didn't have television experience, you know, that kind of gamble.
And why did Bodenheimer take that risk? What was he thinking?
I think that he saw in John Skipper someone who, first and foremost, understands not only how to lead people, but also understands how to create good content. That John Skipper's background in publishing was all about content, and it's migrating that content. So it went from being on the printed page and books and magazines and everything else to now on the television. But the fact that it was visual still didn't change, I think, in George's mind, the fact that it was still ultimately content. And he had a lot of faith in Skipper's ability to manage and create content.
And, of course, that's personified today probably most strongly in Bill Simmons.
Yes. Well, I mean, look, John Skipper and John Walsh, who's an executive vice president there, have been big proponents of Bill Simmons. Not that he needs proponents, but they have been working very hard to keep him there, which they did. And then they've been incredibly, I guess, generous in the sense of setting up Grantland.com.
Talk a little bit about some of the early personalities at ESPN, and certainly they're you know, etched into the sports consciousness of any fan, whether it was Dan Patrick and Keith Olbermann or Chris Berman, who you mentioned before. I mean, these are people whose personalities have become as large in some cases as the people they were covering.
I think that's part of the reason that happens is because we were living with ESPN so much. I mean, we watch these people every single day. When Keith and Dan were doing SportsCenter, you know, they became part of the cultural fabric, you know, media fabric of in the country. And I think that you have an opportunity when you're at ESPN. I mean, Stuart Scott has his own kind of fan base, and Craig Kilborn and Rich Eisen, and, you know, a lot of people. Robin Roberts, you know, GMA, right. She started at ESPN. So I think that it's been, even though ESPN doesn't like to create stars, they like the brand to be the star. I think that history has proven otherwise.
Well, talk about that they don't like individuals to become stars, that they want to push the brand. I mean, over the years, though, it has served them well to have some of these people become stars.
It served them well, but at the same time, I mean, look, let's think about what do stars want, right? I mean, stars want special privileges and more money. That's nothing that ESPN wants to be in business. They don't want to be held hostage like that. So, you know, one executive says in the book that he'd rather have robots read the news, do anchor SportsCenter. because they don't want that. So I think there's a reason why the Keith Obermans and Dan Patricks and the Craig Gilborns, Rich Eisens, and others, a lot of those have left.
It's interesting that that is a debate that has played out in various sports as well. You know, David Stern, who has always been pushing individual stars versus, you know, even the early days of the NFL, and Pete Rozelle, who really was pushing more teams than stars. I mean, that's a debate that's played out in the business.
Absolutely. And, you know, look, there's been different approaches through the years. And, you know, it's not to say one is better than the other, but I think it certainly works better for ESPN not to have the kind of hierarchy that some of the other places do. They just can't manage it.
One of the things that you managed to do in the book, and those guys have all the fun, is get a lot of people to talk. And yet you say that one of the most important things in the culture of ESPN today is that they don't want people talking ill about anyone else. How did those two things work together in this project?
Well, the truth is that people were afraid after they talk to me, because they were afraid that some of what they might have said would get them in trouble. And indeed, since the book has been out, there's been a lot of people apologizing to other people. ESPN does not like staffers to criticize other staffers, so Bill Simmons had to apologize to Mike Tirico, and Tony Kornheiser had to apologize to Mike Tirico, and there's been a lot of apologies that they just will not allow the culture to deteriorate like that, as they call it.
The one person, though, that everybody feels comfortable talking about is Obermann, it seems.
Yes, they're not afraid of that. Yes, it's the rules are different for somebody who's left.
I guess. Finally, what is it like there today? What is ESPN like today when you look at it through the lens of this remarkable 32-year history?
I think that it's a place that is very happy with where it's at, but still looking ahead and seeing, you know, is there a new era? What's going to be, you know, that next big mountain to climb? And it may be technological, it may be programming, but they are definitely going to conquer it once they see it.
James Andrew Miller, book is Those Guys Have All the Fun, Inside the World of ESPN, just out from Little Brown. Jim, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much.